Hello and welcome to the Spin Podcast Talk Show. I'm your host, Eric Devenny, and today we have a great show lined up for you. I have the pleasure of speaking with Tony Cross with Seasonal Color Pots, but first, a word from our sponsors. The Spin Podcast Talk Show is brought to you by UBA, United Business Alliance, a strategic alliance and business consulting firm who strives to make its clients more profitable through concentrated efforts on business fundamentals. In addition, the Spin Podcast Talk Show has one available sponsorship position open and is currently accepting bids. To learn more, please visit our website at usspin.com. That is usspin.com. Or email us at podcast@usspin.com. That's podcast@usspin.com. Well, anyways, let's get on with the show. As many of you already know, the point of the Spin Podcast Talk Show is to make you more successful and more profitable through the information delivered to you through the interview process with other small business owners, entrepreneurs, and professionals. So with that, Tony Cross with Seasonal Colored Pots has over 10 years of business experience in the landscape field, landscape and design. She has been a business owner for over 5 years and has concentrated in pot design, maintenance, and installation for over the last 3. So without further ado, Tony, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Eric.
Well, how about let's hop right on into it. I always like it when we have guests on the talk show to kind of start off with telling a little bit about themselves, their history, possibly even why you got involved with Spin. But you're a member of Spin, why don't you give us your 60-second spotlight? And if you want to take a little extra time, go for it.
Okay, that's great. Well, as you know, the name of my company is Seasonal Color Pots, and I tell people I design beauty in small spaces because I design, install, and provide maintenance for container plantings. And these are the large plantings, the large planters you see at homes and businesses with various different types of shrubs and trees in them, maybe seasonal color flowers and grasses in front of small businesses and particularly at residences. I have been in business, in the landscaping business, for 10 years, and I've been in business for myself since 2000, and I've been exclusively in this business since 2003. But I have always, all along the way, since I've been in landscaping, done container design, but I've concentrated on it exclusively over the last 3 years.
Interesting. So, kind of tell me, why did you decide to take the leap from, working in the same industry into owning your own business?
Well, I think because there were certain creative directions I wanted to grow in that I wasn't sure I could experience working for someone else. Also, I really like personal customer contact. I like being in direct contact with my customers, and I like being able to give them answers as opposed to having to go back to a boss and say, well, what should I tell this person? So I think that's one of the main reasons. And mostly, though, I think it's because I had a particular creative direction I wanted to go, and I felt that I needed to shape that with my own hands as opposed to leaving it up to someone else.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I hear quite often that people, they kind of want to, take charge of either their career or their life and be able to mold it a little bit more. It kind of sounds like you were also in that situation.
Don't go into business for yourself if you want to take control of your life. That strictly won't happen.
Oh, amen.
But, I think, if you have an idea of what you'd like to do and you're willing to go through the struggles to make that happen, and you're an organized person and can hack it out, I think you should at least try it. I mean, it may not always be this way. It can be a lonely pursuit to be the boss, but I enjoy it.
Oh, sounds good. Well, how about you take me back 10, 11 years, and when you were first getting into the industry, what was kind of your mind shift, and what really excited you about I'm going to use the terminology of landscaping, but I know you can probably define it better than I can.
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. Well, I have always been in the arts. I have a master's degree in fine arts, and I was in a different area of the arts for most of my career. I went to school for that, and I was in that business until I was about 40, so for about 15 years. And then I took a little foray into a more sort of expected area. I was actually working in an insurance brokerage for a couple of years. And it was a great group of people there, and I certainly learned a lot about insurance. I got great consumer education in that office, I must say, that has continued to help me throughout my life, so I really appreciate that experience. But I wasn't really interested in continuing in that, and I looked around and I thought, well, what else do I really enjoy doing? What are the sorts of things I really enjoy doing? Because if you're going to spend most of your days at a pursuit, you should enjoy doing it, I think. And what I liked to do at the time was gardening. So I began to take classes at one of the horticultural programs, and I quit my office job after I had taken one class, as a matter of fact, and did maintenance with a small maintenance company. A woman who was running a maintenance company had asked, and I had worked with her a little bit before part-time, asked me to come on and work with her. And then I worked for two different landscape design and installation companies, and then I started my own maintenance company, which I ran for a while, and again, all along the way, I was doing container installations, and then I really wanted to do more creative work and less maintenance work, and that's when I decided to do containers full-time. But the main thing was I wanted to be, to me, you can never learn enough about plants. You can never learn enough about soils. You can never learn enough about the cultural needs of living things, and there was this exponential room for growth, for always discovering something, for always researching something, and you know, I'm sure other businesses are very much the same way for people who are involved in those businesses, but particularly with living things, because living things are ultimately unpredictable, and I really enjoyed that aspect of it. I thought that I could never learn enough. And indeed, that has been the case, and that's really the thing that charged me up about it the most. And I, you know, I come from a long line of farmers, and my father says my grandmother could put a rock on the ground and it would grow something.
Oh, that's kind of nice to have that that touch.
But you know, you don't inherit your gardening skills; you have to work at it. So I don't like to discourage people. I don't believe in brown thumbs. I just believe in folks who just haven't studied enough yet. But that is what he says. Okay. So that's how I got here.
Oh, interesting, interesting. Well, I'm going to kind of segue. But first, before I do, I wanted to kind of get a full understanding of all the programs, the products, the services that you and your company provide so that we'll kind of have a context when we're talking about some of the other questions that I'm going to ask you.
Sure. Well, we really only provide container design and installation, although I do, of course, do bed design, small bed design, like raised beds and planters, and I have designed perennial gardens in the past, although I don't do that sort of thing anymore. So we really concentrate on designing, installing, and maintaining large container plantings or large planter plantings.
Okay.
That's all we do.
Okay. And kind of give me a little bit of a timeline of a, you know, just your average project. How much is in design, how much is in installation, and how much maintenance is normally required to keep it up to snuff and up to par?
Sure. Well, I try to get people thinking about their containers as early as possible once Christmas is over, because by the time you put a thought in people's heads and the time they actually act on it can take a while. But you really, usually people begin really thinking about their container installations in about April. You know, we have a beautiful day today, and when things start to warm up and things start to bloom, people begin to think about their gardens again. So about April for the spring and summer installation is when people start thinking about them. And then I don't begin installation until 1st of May at the earliest, and I really prefer to wait, depending on the area of the sort of three-county area my clients are in, I prefer to wait until even the second week of May, because things can just drown or freeze out depending on where you are. And then installation can go on right up until after the 4th of July sometimes. But you want to get most of your stuff in by, you know, the end of June, because we have a relatively short growing season, and you won't really get to see much of a change if you don't get everything in by the end of June.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
And then on the continual service side?
Pardon?
And then on the continual maintenance, how often do you need to be checking on these things?
With your summer installations, containers need to be maintained at least once a week. They, even if they're not heavily floral, and I do a lot of containers that aren't heavily floral, nonetheless, they need to be cleaned up just about once a week. And if you're hand watering, they need to be attended to more than that. Most of my clients have an automatic watering system. Either their containers have their own water zone in the general landscape watering, or they are watered from a bed zone in the general landscape watering, or we water them from a clock and a hose bib attachment clock with, it's quite a setup that waters the containers. Watering is one of the most critical things that can happen with containers, and in our cold springs, one of the worst problems we have is people overwatering their containers. So I really try to encourage people to hire our maintenance if they possibly can, and if not, to hire us at least through the first part of the installation. And if they're not even, if their budget doesn't allow for that, I do provide really specific instructions. The problem is getting people to follow those instructions to keep their containers looking good. And then a lot of people, of course, change out the color in September, and we put in fall and winter containers. And the fall and winter containers, I try to get them to, last until April at least. Although in February, when primroses come out, if people want to change a flower, then we put primroses in. But generally, once you put the fall containers in, we don't change them out again until the following spring.
Oh, interesting.
And fall containers don't need nearly as much maintenance because, of course, it's not hot.
Mm-hmm.
They don't need a lot of fertilization, needless to say, and they don't grow very much. So you can really put in a very full fall container. You would never be able to do that in the spring because it would simply grow too much.
Okay. One quick question before we get into a lot of the business topics. The number one thing I hear about anytime when I'm talking with people who are in design, architecture, landscaping, is feng shui, especially living here on the West Coast. It's been a long-term popularity or an area of interest. So I was just wondering, do you have any background in that, and do you design with feng shui in mind?
I don't have any background in that, or although I will tell you, I do have a red door on my house, which is supposed to be very good for attracting money, I think.
Oh, good.
But that just worked out that way. I didn't do it on purpose.
Okay.
Although it's really a maroon door. I'm not sure if that's the same thing.
No.
Interesting that you should ask me that, because I'm currently talking to a new client who has a feng shui advisor. And while I don't know anything about feng shui, I'm the first to admit that, I think there's a way to work with that in terms of the design that I do. And really, my understanding of feng shui on the most reduced level is when you use it in your home to determine how you're going to design the inside of your home, that it really is a design philosophy. And I think all good design shares a similar philosophy of contrast and complement and change and et cetera. So I don't think that it's that far flung from anything else, but personally I don't have any skills in feng shui per se, no.
Okay, well, I just thought I would ask. Well, let's hop into the business questions. As listeners who have listened to a recording or a podcast episode before this one, they know that I send out questions to all the interviewees ahead of time so that we can kind of go through some of those. And question 14, which I kind of was curious about your answer, the question is, are your potential customers easily reachable? And it's kind of a 1 out of 10, how would you rate them? And you put a 5, kind of right in the middle. So I kind of wanted to get a little bit more understanding of what is your views on how reachable your customers are, and why did you rate them, rate that particular question a 5?
Well, that's very hard to say, actually. I find that I reach most of my customers through personal contact, through dedicated personal contact and targeting them, as it were. I don't just run into my customers. I think they're not particularly easy to reach, but, I mean, I guess that's why I rated it a 5. I don't think they're particularly easy to reach. I don't think I sell something that's particularly easy to sell because it's a luxury item. It's like selling Rolex watches or whatever, although, needless to say, my containers don't cost what a Rolex watch costs. But I think they're not particularly easy to reach, and that's why I rated them at a 5.
Okay, okay. And number 16 is, what is the level of value added to your customers through your product? And I'm kind of going to refresh your memory of your answer and bring the audience up to the present. And you kind of said, you know, your customers receive the satisfaction of seeing something grow and develop into a reality in a very short amount of time. And so along those lines, I kind of wanted to ask you, you know, what emotional attachment or what emotion do you believe is most important to tap into when you're talking to your customers and when you're explaining the services that you give? What is that emotion that really excites them?
You know, I think my personal feeling about having living things around you, particularly plants, is that what they add to your environment is almost it's not imperceptible, but it's very subtle and it is very real. Having living things around us changes us. You know, I mean, why did you get a dog or whatever, or why did you decide to have children, or why did you marry, or whatever that question may be. Living things change us, and plants change us. They add something back in our environment that's very important, and it's not just, you know, sucking up our carbon dioxide either. You know, why do we go to the mountains, or why do we take a walk in one of our parks? Being surrounded by green things or colorful things changes our attitude. So I think it operates on us in that way. And with container design, I say one of the reasons I like this kind of landscaping is because I have a very short attention span, and I like to see what I do come together in a short amount of time. So my containers, you know, they're in May, they've done their thing, and they're out in September, and I've seen the whole show in the space of 3 months. I like that aspect of it because it can always be, it's always changing. And, of course, I like a beautifully designed garden as well, but I don't do that. So I think that's what I like the most about them. A lot of times when you put in a fully designed garden, you need a good 7 years before you can see what you put in come to fruition. And, you know, most people leave their first home within 7 years, whereas if you put in a container planting, you can see it do its thing in a very short amount of time. And I think that provides a certain amount of satisfaction for people.
Okay. Great answer. I'm just going to kind of take right on off of that and move down into, you know, the whole industry of landscaping, I'm going to speak more generally here, but of landscaping and specifically of what you do, has been going through change probably over the past 15 years, maybe plus, you know, with the big box stores, Home Depot, Lowe's, etc. And so I wanted to get your opinion of what you saw as the major concerns for people in the field and where you see the industry going. Could you bring some light on those two subjects?
Sure. Well, you know, it's interesting. I just went to a meeting of one of my professional organizations this morning, which is the Association of Professional Landscape Designers. And one thing we discussed was helping people understand what things cost, what really good work costs. And my husband laughs and says, the reason we have a hard time doing that is because everyone can garden badly. Not everyone wants to plumb badly or do electrical work in their home badly, although we certainly know those who have. But everyone sort of thinks they can garden, even if they garden badly. And everyone can garden at a certain level. Not everyone can design and install a garden at the level, you know, that a professional does, nor can they do what I do. Yes, the big box stores tend to let everyone think that they can do it themselves, and that is a perception that we often run up against, that the homeowner job is the same as the professional job. And personally, as I discover looking around my own home at the things I've done, I know the difference between that and the professionals I have come in to do real work for me. There's quite a distinct difference. So I think part of it is being able to distinguish ourselves as professionals and the charges we have from going into the big box store and buying, you know, a plastic pot or buying preformed pavers or whatever. And the other thing I have to say about that is we all have to live with whatever budgets that we have. And certainly I have things in my home, and you have things in your home and your garden and my garden that was the best we could afford at that time. But I know the difference between that and what really quality material is. I know the difference between those things. And sometimes it's hard to convey to people what the difference between the box store product and a professional, really professional product is. I'm not sure the box stores do much to get people jazzed on landscaping. I think the box stores get people jazzed on trying to do it for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a difficult thing we face. Our industry also faces the same sort of challenges a lot of industries have faced, which is over the last 15 years, there are several very large entities across the whole country who have purchased much smaller companies in each area of the country they have moved into. And I won't necessarily name them, but they are in all parts of the country. They're nationally based companies almost, and they have moved into each area by buying smaller companies. So gradually, smaller and smaller companies are being absorbed or pushed out by larger and larger companies. And therefore, your choices will be reduced. I mean, that's about the only way to say that. The other thing, I think, which is quite apparent to anyone who looks at the landscaping industry, and we are considered an agricultural industry, is that there is still a need for people to do seasonal work. And that's harder and harder to find in the United States because people cannot afford to take purely seasonal work anymore, and that creates a big problem for us in terms of finding the labor that we need in our industry among our own citizens. And I personally find that quite distressing, but it's just a fact of life, and again, that exists all across the country. I'm not sure how to change that, but I just think it's a fact of life.
Oh, yeah, if we could change all the things the way we liked them, wouldn't things be easy?
Yes.
Great. Thanks for providing all that insight on specifically those topics. I'm going to kind of piggyback off of your answer. You talked a little bit about costs and on competition of large companies moving into the market via purchasing smaller companies. And so I kind of wanted to get a better understanding of some of your controls over cost and even pricing. You know, I know you probably purchase your pots and other materials via wholesale. Mm-hmm. And so one example would be, you know, gas has been going up. I don't know how much you have to do about driving around to customers' locations, but that has obviously affected a lot of companies.
Yeah.
How has some of those rising costs lately affected your company, and how have you been able to either push those onto the customer, or have you been able to with your controls over price with the larger companies moving into the market?
Well, regardless of what consumers may think, every single cost is passed down to them. You know, our whole economic system is a circle of costs being passed from one person to the next person. That's how it works. And if someone thinks that a company is not passing the increase in gas prices or soil or whatever onto them, they're kind of living in a dream world. Somewhere those costs are getting taken care of. Whether you're totally aware of it or not. And, you know, if you could see someone's numbers on their business, you'd know where those costs were getting passed on to you, but you won't ever see that.
Mm-hmm.
I control my costs really closely because I am still a sole proprietorship, and every receipt passes through my personal hand. Although, I wish it weren't always that way, but it is indeed that way. So my costs are very tightly controlled. I will give you an example, though. For instance, some of our nurseries, our growers that we buy from, they pass their fuel costs on in the form of a fuel surcharge. They just simply add an extra charge onto every delivery, and that's their fuel surcharge to cover the cost of the fuel. some plants have gone up significantly this year, I have noticed. Well, you know, I would say by, they've gone up, say, 50 cents a plant. That's, you know, that's something. That's a significant rise in cost for a plant.
Is that about 10%, 20%, 50%?
Like on an annual, that's probably a 35% increase.
Oh, wow.
You know? And that's on account of the cost of fuel, because you have to have fuel to grow plants in a greenhouse.
Mm.
And, of course, you have to have electricity, you have to have heat, and that's all rolled into the cost of the plant. So those increased costs, whether you buy that plant in a retail nursery or whether you buy it through a landscaper who sells it to you, you are paying for increased fuel costs and the increased cost of plants and materials, because it takes more fuel to deliver that soil to your house, or it takes more fuel to deliver those pots to the United States, or whatever. So the cost, basically the cost of our fuel is the thing driving up prices everywhere right now, but I think particularly also in the landscaping industry.
Interesting. And let me ask you one quick question. We had the boom of the real estate market, housing prices hitting record highs, builders building every square inch they could find. How did that boom over the last several years affect you and your industry?
Well, it was very good for our industry up to a point, because more people, you know, wanted landscaping. In a big development, I'm not sure that it affects quite so many people, because generally a developer will, you know, they're hiring out with a rather large company to do the landscaping in their development. The worst situation is when a developer ends up doing the landscaping themselves, and that always tends to show that the developer has done that. Again, you know, I don't drive nails. I do plants. And so hire the person who knows how to do the job is my particular theory about it. It has been good for the industry. Just like everybody else, in 2001, the industry took a tremendous downturn. And with the stock market declining, people really pulled in their money in a hurry. The industry took another hit last year. My industry took another hit last year when the drought was declared in, I think, April. We were fortunate in that all through the month of May we received rain, so we didn't actually have a drought, and I personally understand the reasons for declaring the drought so early, but the industry took another hit because people said, I'm not going to plant this spring, I'm going to plant in the fall. And that, again, caused us, you know, it caused a decline. So I'm not an overall industry predictor. I just know the small things that have affected me, and I certainly did notice a difference. After 2001, people were definitely spending money less freely, and that has continued. I mean, that has definitely continued for the last 5 years.
Interesting. What would you say is the biggest thing that your company is facing today and you'll probably be facing over the next 5 years, the biggest hurdle that your company has to overcome?
My personal company, I think my biggest hurdle is marketing and name recognition. How to continue to make that work for me, how to find the right places to advertise my company, how to control my costs continue to control my costs is another hurdle I face. I'm very well organized, and I don't really have an organizational cost. I think there are a lot of people out there doing what I do. I think I've told you before, not only are there a lot of people who do containers out there, there are a lot of landscaping companies that also do containers out there, whether they have a single person who does it or whether they have several people who do it for them. And I think distinguishing myself from those people and, creating a name recognition for my company is going to be the biggest hurdle I have.
Interesting. Getting your name out there and getting it remembered is a hurdle I think every company has to face. How to do that, they definitely pay marketing executives and branding executives a lot of money to figure out all those problems. And I know an example of GM, they just got rid of their ad agency because they felt that they weren't getting the name recognition and people excited enough over their current cars. So it doesn't matter, I think, if you're a small company or a Fortune 500 company, you know, we're always facing that situation. So
we are, and you know, personally, as someone who considers herself fairly immune to advertising, I hope none of my customers are like me. That's all I can say. Because I am really, and always have been this way since I became an adult, very resistant to advertising. I don't just run out and buy something, and I can really resist a sales pitch very strongly. I'm not sure where that comes from, but probably because I'm from Missouri and you have to show me, and so I have to, it takes me a while to succumb to the sales pitch. But I think people are inundated, as you know, you read this everywhere, in so many messages, so many things, so many pieces of paper coming into their house, so much stuff, that they do tend to just go to a numb place and not listen. And, you know, I can see how that happens for people. I can see how they simply stop listening. And I think that, you know, maybe you have to speak with the still small voice, as they say, instead of the... Maybe you have to appear in the still small voice instead of in the burning bush.
Oh.
If that makes any sense to you.
No, that definitely does. That definitely does make sense. So anyways, I wanted to really quickly hop back to when we were discussing about pricing. And, you know, as you said, all costs are eventually passed on to whoever the customer is in one way, shape, or form. Has your field specifically faced a lot of pricing competition, competitors doing discounts or lowering their prices because they've moved into the market and they want to capture a percentage of the market share?
I see. Yes, I see what you're asking. I think one of the things you face, for instance, is the big box store selling, you know, primroses for 99 cents when you're selling them for, I don't know, $1.50, we'll say. And one thing I've never actually had a client question my charges. They're either jazzed on the idea of doing the project or they're not. I rarely have seen people who saw the cost go out and try to get it done more cheaply. I really don't see that because sometimes, you know, I still have contact with whatever that was. The group of landscapers I am most involved with are generally not undercutting one another with pricing. When someone is undercutting a price, one thing you have to understand when you're looking at pricing is nobody doesn't make a profit and stay in business. Somewhere they are making a profit. And if your competitor controls their costs so well that they can, you know, sell their product more cheaply than you can, less expensively than you can, well, then maybe you need to control your costs more. But sometimes when people are selling something at a great discount, what you're going to find is that the material you wind up with is not the material you thought you were going to get. The end product you wind up with is not the end product you thought you were going to get. One thing, you know, I recently read in somewhere said, don't be the cheapest, be the best. And that's something I focus on a lot. I think the big box stores, for instance, can sell things really cheaply, but I'm not sure they can sell the quality. And if someone ever did question my price on, let's say, a primrose, for instance, I guess I would have to say this. Getting you what you want and doing business is all about forming good working relationships with growers and suppliers and all the people who go together to make this project happen. If suddenly I needed something for you that you desperately needed right away, I couldn't go out to Home Depot to a manager and say, hey, I need 15 flats of this particular color primrose. If it's there, it's there. But I can go to my grower I've done business with for 7 years, and I can say, hey, this family is having a wedding, and we have got to get 15 flats of yellow begonias on this date. Can you help me? And my grower will step up to the plate for me. And so what I am able to do is to provide an assurance about the quality I'm going to get and having things there at the right time. Now, of course, no one likes to do business at the last minute because you're likely to be disappointed. But I have formed those kinds of relationships with people over the years that justify the prices I charge because I'm not delivering the cheapest thing. I'm delivering the quality to the client. And that's only done by forming long-term relationships with people. It's not formed by running around getting the cheapest thing. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. You know, I was going to kind of ask you to illuminate and shed some light on exactly the kind of business partnerships you have, which ones you consider the most important. You know, maybe if you would name two or three of who you consider to be your most important partners for your long-term success, that would definitely be an interesting thing to learn a little bit more about your company and how it really your success is interwoven with multiple other people or other businesses'
sure.
success.
Well, I hesitate to name all my suppliers necessarily, but
you could name industry or profession.
Oh,
you don't need to.
Definitely the nursery industry. The nursery industry is an incredibly valuable industry to this whole state in terms of industries that contribute income back into the state coffers, and of course to my industry. The landscapers in the nursery industry are intimately involved and inextricably linked. I make a joke because, you know, when spring rolls around in the landscaping industry, we call that Christmas, like Christmas in the retail industry. Everybody's crazy. Everybody wants the same thing right at the same moment, and people are very stressed out. But do not be mean to your nursery person. Whatever you do, treat your nursery person as well as you can, because they hold the power of life and death over you, really. So my partnerships with nursery, with when I say the nursery industry, that is the growers, because of course I don't walk into a retail nursery and buy retail plants for my clients. Not necessarily. I mean, that's not always true, but mostly I purchase wholesale. And then my relationships with the people who provide my soil, the people who provide the containers are of course an incredible relationship for me, and they frankly have been wonderful over the years, absolutely wonderful. And they're all very, I mean, in my circle of suppliers, all very nice people. I don't see any reason to do business with people who aren't nice people. And those are the people who have contributed to the success of my business, is the nursery industry, the people who supply the physical containers themselves, and you know, the people who provide the soil that I put the plants in.
Sounds good. Sounds good. Thanks for kind of allowing us to get a full understanding of, you know, who your suppliers are and who you really rely on. Kind of on the other flip side, is there a customer base that you rely heavily on that you are normally delivering your services to? Is it families with children or dinks, dual income, no kids, specific
dinks?
Locations? I have several dinks in my family, so I use the terminology a lot.
Did you make that up?
Oh no, it's there's a magazine. It's Dinks is the name of it, and it's dual income, no kids, and it talks about, you know, what things you can do when you don't have kids and et cetera, et cetera. But so anyways, I was just wondering, since we got to see who your suppliers and partners are in delivering your services,
right,
who is on the other side of that coin?
Well, you know, it's not always a dual-income family, but it's usually a family, it's a rather higher-income family, I'll put it that way. I kind of hate the term high-end because it implies, I don't know, it doesn't really describe people accurately, I don't think, any more than blue-collar describes people accurately or working-class describes people accurately. It's just a hook for us to talk about something. Sometimes they have children. They tend to be people, if they have children, they tend to be people in more comfortable circumstances. If they have no children, you know, they may just be middle-class people. But they do tend to be people, residential people at any rate, those clients with, you know, more disposable income. Because, again, I'm selling a luxury. I know it. And in terms of the small businesses, right now, as I told you, I have just begun to market to a certain segment of small business, and the small businesses I am marketing to, really, the owner of the business is still intimately involved in the business because I like the one-on-one relationship. I like for someone to own what they do because I believe that I have a greater simpatico with that person. because they own what they do and I own what I do, and they are generally pursuing something that is probably a little bit outside the norm, and I think I pursue something that's a little bit outside the norm, and I think that we can benefit each other. So when I'm pursuing a business, those are the sorts of businesses I look at, people who are sort of thinking outside the usual realm of things. And I guess if I want to use just a catchphrase, a high-end residential client.
Oh, okay, okay.
But they might have dogs and kids and the whole nine yards.
The whole nine yards.
They don't really fall into a box, I don't think.
Okay. Also along those lines, what percentage of your business, I will say, is residential or customer base, and what percent is commercial small business owners, as you talked about?
I would say right now about 75% of my business is residential and 25% is small business based.
And over the next 5 years, where do you see most of your growth coming from, the commercial side or the residential?
I think they'll both continue to grow fairly equally. I think the percentages will probably break down just about the same, although I think residential will eventually, it'll be more of a 60-40 mix. I think that's how it will go. But I think they'll probably grow about the same. I think they'll grow to the degree that I tend to market to either of those segments of the population.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't continue to market to a particular segment, that segment won't grow. So it seems to me that will be the situation.
Would you say during a recession, a downturn in the economy, which segment is less affected for you? Is it the residential customer who wants to have a beautiful looking home, or is it the commercial owner who realizes they need to have a good looking business for customers to continually come in there and wanting to spend their money?
Right. It is definitely the residences. The residences tend to remain steadier than the commercial work does.
Oh, okay. Okay, interesting. Well, kind of as we wrap up and bring this interview to a close, I wanted to ask you, where do you see you taking the company in the next 5 years? Are you looking at opening up another office in another city? Are you looking at hiring? Are you looking at keeping it small, compact, possibly interns, franchising? You know, there's a lot of options. And I would love to know, and I'm sure our listeners would like to know, you know, where you see your company going in the next 5-10 years.
Well, I certainly intend to, I see myself hiring more. I certainly see that. No, a franchise wouldn't apply to my business. I can't imagine that happening. At one time I pictured myself being a lot larger than I am, and then I began to look at a lot of things I like about my business, and I don't think they would transfer well into a really large venue. I mean, I don't see myself becoming a nationwide company at all. I always see myself having my hands in the dirt. And I think that that's important to me, to have my hands in the dirt. I don't always see myself hauling a big container off the back of my truck by myself. I don't like that. I'm ready to let go of that particular thing at some time. But I always see myself intimately involved in my company. I'm certainly happy for it to grow as much as it can comfortably absorb. But I always see myself at the helm of my company, being involved in some of the day-to-day activities, some of the field work at least, and of course always in the day-to-day activities of the company. That's what I see.
Interesting. Okay.
I'd like to do this work as long as I'm physically able to do this work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I see happening.
Sounds good, Tony. Well, Tony, let me just say I love and have really enjoyed getting to spend this time with you and interview you, and thanks for coming on the show and spending your time with us. And I know the listeners have enjoyed it as well, and let me just ask you one final closing question. If there are listeners out there who would want to get in contact with you, how would they go about that?
Well, thank you for asking. First, I'll direct you to the website, which is www.seasonalcolorpots.com. And the phone number for the business is 206-781-1060. Our fax number is 789-2222. And I can be reached at Tony, T-O-N-I, at seasonalcolorpots.com.
Thank you so much, Tony. Just to let everyone know, we will be putting Tony's contact information in the podcast notes so that all of you can just access that information also from the website if you didn't have a pen handy when Tony gave that out. Well, Tony, thanks again for coming on, and we wish you the best of luck.
Great. Thanks very much, Eric.
As we conclude this episode of the Spin Podcast Talk Show, I would like to thank our sponsors, UBA, United Business Alliance, and remind all of you that we are accepting bids for the final sponsorship position. If you would like to get in touch with the show, contact us at 1-800-521-4304 or email podcast@usspin.com. That is podcast@usspin.com.